Hey, Monster Hunters. If you're enjoying Beast and Bible, please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And don't forget to share it with somebody who might like it. Now, on to the show. It was another day making a routine stop at the local grocery store on the way home. That day, I had chosen Hy-Vee as the place to procure a few common items. Things like dish soap, toilet paper, chips, salsa, and sparkling water were just a few of the things I had put in my cart. Nothing fancy. The routine came to a sudden halt, however, when the cashier hit the total button and the amount was displayed. $66.66. There was an awkward pause, followed by a, "Whoa, do you want to add a pack of gum or mints or something?" This has happened to me before. Whether it was $6.66, or $66.66, or even $6.67, the proximity of three sixes that close together, even one or two numbers off, creates ripples of fear even among some nominally religious people. That day, I decided to press my luck, and I said, "No, I'm just fine with the total the way it is." Suddenly, there was an earthquake, and a giant hole opened in aisle 5, sending jars of pickles, cans of refried beans, and boxes of stovetop stuffing crashing to the ground. All manner of hideous creatures leapt from the crevice, belching fire and snarling. People screamed and ran as the nightmarish beings ripped shelves apart and slashed at anyone within their vicinity. I just barely made it out with my life, disappointed I had to leave my groceries behind. Since that fateful day, Hy-Vee has instituted a policy whereby posters are hung informing customers what combination of products will result in an unholy total that will open up a portal to hell. No, of course that didn't actually happen, but based on the way some people behave around the 666, you'd think it was a real possibility. The Mark of the Beast has been a subject of speculation since people first read about it in the Book of Revelation, and yes, that's the Book of Revelation, not the Book of Revelations. Please give a judgmental side eye to anyone who makes it plural. The mark is discussed in Revelation 13:15-18, where an entity known as the Earth Beast is wreaking havoc on the earth. The Bible states, "Also, it, the beast, causes all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave, to be marked on the right hand or the forehead, so that no one can buy or sell who does not have the mark, that is, the name of the beast or the number of its name. This calls for wisdom. Let anyone with an understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a person. Its number is 666. I have heard people suggest the mark is everything from a literal tattoo to a microchip implant and barcodes to the COVID vaccine. But many alleged marks of the beast simply follow Cohen's first thesis of monster theory, namely that the monster is a cultural body that represents the fears and anxieties of a given time. The Mark of the Beast often changes in popular culture to reflect what people are currently freaked out about. While it makes for good entertainment and gossip, that's not the best way to handle the ancient Greek text of the apocalypse. To help me decode this mysterious number, I have invited New Testament scholar and expert in the Book of Revelation, Dr. John Pauline from Loma Linda University in California, to join me on the show today. This episode is simply called The Mark of the Beast. I'm Dr. Seth Pierce, and welcome to Beast and Bible. Dr. Pauline, thank you so much for being here with us today.
It's good to be with you today. I've been looking forward to this.
Me too. So let's get right into it. What is the strangest thing you have heard associated with the Mark of the Beast?
Well, that's an interesting one. The strangest thing, I don't know how strange it is, but when barcoding first came out, some people were suggesting that that was the precursor to the Mark of the Beast. And, you know, someday maybe there will be such a thing, but I really do think when you go carefully into Revelation as it originally was written, you're not going to go into a physical direction like that. I think it's more of a spiritual mark. So, and I guess we'll get into that a little more deeply if you'd like.
Sure. So ideas like it's a microchip or it's some sort of a tattoo, you know, not it.
Yeah. Well, I remember there was a time when Ronald Wilson Reagan had 6 digits in each of his 3 names, and some people thought maybe he was the, you know, the 666, the mark of the beast. So, I mean, people are curious about it and willing to try almost anything to try to resolve it. I think very few have really carefully looked at the text in its original context to try to understand. You know, God chose to give revelation in 95 AD, not 1995 or 2025.
Right.
He did that for a reason, and it had to make some sense then. That doesn't mean that what they could have understood covers everything. No. But if it made no sense to them, then there would be no point in God giving it in 95 AD.
Sure.
We need to start, you know, that sort of sets some limits against speculation when we start with the original context and what it could possibly have meant back then.
So given that it's such an ancient idea in an ancient sacred text, why do you think it holds such a fascination outside of the Christian community?
Well, I think the secular world is into sound bites. It's into easily rememberable things. You know, the four horsemen, the 666, mark of the beast, these are things that have gone beyond the religious world because they imply that an interesting future, perhaps a perilous future. And if there's going to be a perilous future, then we need to know about that so we can be prepared. If it's an interesting future, well, we'd kind of like to know ahead of time what it is so we can tell everybody else that we know.
Yeah, it kind of makes us feel special and important.
Yeah, So I, you know, who am I to talk since I probably spent more time on the 7 trumpets than anybody else who's ever lived. And so, you know, obviously one can become fascinated with things that may or may not be life-changing in their significance. I have not met, but I'm aware of a fellow who actually wrote nearly 900 pages simply on the 666.
Wow.
You know, the number.
Yeah.
And it's good. I mean, it reads like a novel. You know, he goes all through history, what different people said about it, and then explores different possibilities, et cetera. It's really, really good, you know, but that's a lot of energy on something that may or may not be life-changing. I did ask him once, you know, I says, how has that made you a better person? And his response was, that's an irrelevant question.
Wow.
And I get it, you know.
Yeah, and it's always tricky, too. I think when you are a researcher, there are certain things that you hope that are practical, and then some things you're like, I'm just doing this because I find it fascinating. So the number 666 makes appearances all over popular culture, and people find ways to use it as a fashion statement, whether it's on clothes or jewelry or tattoos. And it even freaks out cashiers at the grocery store. I don't know if you've had this experience, but I know I've been through it. I don't even remember what I bought, but the total was $6.66. And you get kind of a reaction, you know, from a cashier or maybe the people in line. And so one question I wanted to ask you, is there anything inherently powerful or sinister about the number 666?
Well, when you're thinking of the book of Revelation, clearly the best positive number, the most important positive number in Revelation is the number 7. It occurs about 54 times, I believe. And so that's, you know, that's something you'd right away say, okay, what does the 6 have some relation to the 7? And obviously from the start, it's 6 is short of 7.
Yeah.
So it could represent human attempts to achieve what only God can do that fall short, of course. Adam and Eve were created on the 6th day, the one notable thing. So, yeah, I think the idea that that falls short of 7, you know, perhaps the implication is God's number is 777, and a lot of people have said that through history. Although Revelation doesn't use that explicit number, the 666 might well be related to the number 7.
Yeah. But like the physical number, me writing on a piece of paper, or if someone happens to be in that checkout line and they end up with 666, that doesn't, you know, somehow create this opening for evil, you know, in that moment. There's nothing inherently, you know, beyond its symbolic meaning, there's something inherently powerful in your opinion.
I think we are fascinated by certain numbers, especially round numbers. The year 1000 was a big deal among those parts of Europe that actually were aware that it was the year 1000, which was not many. The year 2000 clearly was a huge deal, and I actually wrote a book on that at the request of the Biblical Research Institute at the General Conference, because a lot of people were getting excited with the idea that Jesus was coming in the year 2000, you know, because of the idea that if creation was, say, 4000 BC, the year 2000, you got 6000 years, the millennium makes a Sabbath. A very compelling kind of a narrative there. But it fell short of, you know, biblical certitude, and it got people excited. And the big issue, I think, with setting a date, even if you do it softly, you know, just say, well, it's somewhere between now and 2000, you know, which is how some people put it. Even if you do it softly, when the time comes, it can really, you know, damage people spiritually. I remember, I must have been about 9 years old. And my mom heard something from a preacher about how that Jesus will come as it was in the days of Noah.
Right.
And the preacher noticed that Noah preached 120 years. And then, so the preacher said, well, the Advent movement started in 1844. If this is going to fit the parallel, then Jesus is going to come in 1964.
Okay,
and
yep.
That made a ton of sense to me as a nine-year-old. And I made some strong commitments that I would start getting ready to meet Jesus in 1962. And when 1962 came, I'd kind of forgotten. So you see that there didn't have much value for me. Obviously, we've gone well past 1964, so these things have been falsifiable and have never really worked out. So
you really see people taking numbers, biblical numbers, and ascribing meaning to them, and even though maybe the number itself doesn't have it could be an inaccurate application, there's still a lot of social power behind those numbers as far as getting people to believe, whether it's the second coming or believing themselves to be aligned with demonic forces, you know, depending on how they choose to use the number. So even if the immediate context of scripture has a different idea in mind for that number, and maybe sometimes it's just a number, you know, it's not meant to be taken symbolically, people can still take those numbers and infuse it with meaning that has some very real social consequences.
Well, you make a really good point. I think scripture does use numbers symbolically. For example, in the book of Revelation, the number 3 seems to be associated with God until it's associated with Satan. So in Revelation 13, there's a sense of a counterfeit trinity. You have a dragon, a beast from the sea, a beast from the earth, the three of them, you know. And that becomes significant because God is often described in threes, you know, the one who is and was and is to come, you know, Jesus, the Holy Spirit, the Father, etc. And so when Satan deceives and puts himself forward as the God figure that we should worship, he does so in threes. Dragon, beast, and false prophet. So numbers do seem to have meaning in scripture. The number 4 is often associated with the earth, the four corners of the earth.
Yep.
Number 7, as we've mentioned, is sort of the ideal number, the perfect number. The number 12 tends to be associated with Israel and with the church. So the Bible does put significance into numbers. Human beings, I think, often put significance into numbers and sometimes try to make it as if those are biblical.
Yeah. No, it's good. So from a Christian perspective, how has the number 666 or the mark of the beast been understood? Sort of give us a very brief overview of this concept from perhaps John's day as he is seeing these visions and writing the book of Revelation, to how it's been viewed by Christians through the ages.
Well, I think pretty consistently Christians have viewed that as the number of the Antichrist, that this is a figure which will arise sometime after the time of Revelation, usually at the very end of time. And so people have associated with a lot of figures through history. I mentioned Reagan, who is the one that maybe makes one smile a little bit. He's sort of a jolly old fellow. People have tried, you know, the numbers, it's not just 666. The number is 666. All right. So while the number six may have its own significance, in this particular case, it's 666. And so people have been trying to figure out, can we find somebody in history who's, you know, where the number 666 is important? Or, you know, to figure out maybe their name, you know, if the numerical value of the name would point us in the right direction. And so you've had quite a few people who have taken names of significant figures and tried to associate with the 666. One that's very popular among scholars is the idea Kaiser Neron, you know, Nero Caesar.
Yeah.
Is it Latin or is it in the Aramaic? I'm not sure exactly which language off the top, but people counted that and found out that it added up to 666, and they figured that must be the obvious point here, that he's pointing to the Roman emperor.
Uh-huh.
On the other hand, it's very clear that this number is associated with the end of time, and Rome was not the end of time.
Right.
John may not have been clear on that, how long things would go. He said it's very soon, you know,
yeah.
It's very near. So God may not have revealed to John any kind of sense of the length of time. But clearly, if this is a prediction arising from the inspiration of God, Nero must not be the answer to that question.
Is there any sort of consistent method people have used for calculating these names? Because it seems like, I mean, I've had things too. You know, I pastored for 16 years. I remember getting phone calls. FDR was one. Someone was claiming that they had figured out that it was Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And then I've had Michael Jackson. I had a theory working out names that it seems to be a little bit, or I should say a lot of subjectivity as far as people's calculations.
Well, even Barney, you know, do you remember that cute purple dinosaur?
Yep.
But he figured out that cute purple dinosaur adds up to 666 in Roman letters. So,
you know, I dislike Barney enough that, you know, I don't mind someone making
that. Might actually work out for you.
Yeah. That or Teletubbies. That was also a weird show that gave me the creeps. strange. Yeah. So when was your first real introduction or encounter with the number and the mark of the beast? Do you remember, like, when you really first heard it or heard about it or really first studied it?
Well, I was a weird child, and so I actually spent quite a bit of time, you know, reading the Bible and religious writings and stuff, even when I was 10, 11, 12. So somewhere in there, I would have had my first encounter with the 666, and it might have been a sermon in church or something like that, but it would have been well before adulthood in my case.
So now, as a Seventh-day Adventist Christian scholar and someone who has dedicated a lot of their career to looking at apocalyptic literature and the book of Revelation, how do you approach and interpret these concepts?
As I mentioned, I think that when you do a careful exegesis of the text, you'll see that the issues in the final crisis are spiritual ones.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, just an intellectual identifying this is good, this is bad, it seems to me it's more than that. Two ways, basically, you can go about it. One is to, you know, look for significance in the number, and I mentioned the number six falls short of seven. It's one half of 12. 12 represents Israel, the church. Well, this is one half. So the number seems to be counter to God's numbers.
Right.
And so as a symbol of opposition, this is very, very strong. One thing that they could have noticed, the book of Revelation alludes to the Old Testament constantly. And whatever symbol it is, you want to at least see, is it in the Old Testament? And the interesting thing about it is that in the reign of Solomon, this is mentioned twice, in the reign of Solomon, it mentions in both Kings and Chronicles that his income was 666 talents of gold.
Yes.
In a year. And it happens to come right between the Queen of Sheba story, which is sort of the high point of Solomon's career, when he was faithful to God and people were amazed at his wisdom and they came to learn about God because of Solomon. And then the next story in Kings is the story of him marrying an Egyptian princess who then leads him to build an idol temple on Mount of Olives, opposite the Temple of Solomon. So Solomon's downhill begins right after this. So C.H. Dodd was a very famous New Testament scholar, and he wrote a book called According to the Scriptures. And what he did was examine each of the 276 places where the New Testament quotes the Old Testament without question. All right. And he studied those to say, how does the New Testament use the Old Testament? And he drew a very interesting conclusion. And the conclusion was New Testament writers do not use the Old Testament as a source of proof texts. They were not quoting the Old Testament to prove the point that they were making. They quoted the Old Testament as a pointer to the whole background. And so, for example, it says that Jesus, when he was a child, went to Egypt. And Matthew says this fulfilled prophecy because it says, out of Egypt I called my son. Okay? And that's Hosea 11. But if you go to Hosea 11, it's not a prophecy. It's a symbolic description of the Exodus story. So he's not going to Hosea 11 and saying, Hosea predicted Jesus would go to Egypt. That's not what he's saying, because Hosea didn't predict that. So what's going on here? Well, when you study the Old Testament prophets with some care, you discover the Exodus becomes the model for God's future actions. So God, when he works with the prophets, uses the language of the prophets' past to describe the future. And so Hosea is telling the story of the Exodus. In the Old Testament prophets, whenever the Exodus is brought up, it almost always is pointing to God's future interventions for Israel. And the New Testament takes a lot of those and refers them to Christ and beyond. So what Matthew seems to be doing is saying, here is a pointer text to the way prophets use the Exodus. And so that means that just as the Exodus is a model for what God will do in the future, it was also a model for Jesus that he would have to go down to Egypt because Jesus was a new Israel. So as the new Israel, Jesus goes down to Egypt. He passes through the waters in his baptism. He goes into the wilderness for a period of 40. He goes on a high mountain and delivers his law. See, in Matthew, the Exodus is one model for how Jesus orders his life. So Matthew there is hinting to us, Hosea is not the key. The key is the idea of Jesus as a new Exodus. And when we understand the Exodus and compare it with Jesus' life, we'll understand better what God was doing through Jesus.
Yeah. That's really cool to look at those parallels. And so going back on you mentioning it's in 1 Kings 10 and elsewhere, that 666, looking at the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures as a backdrop for understanding Revelation. One thing I've noticed in reading that story with the tribute of 666 talents of gold is you see Solomon buying chariots from Egypt, which is a weird thing considering this back to the Exodus, right? You know, where Israel, they fled Egypt and were being chased by chariots, and now they've become this religious political power that is buying their chariots from their former oppressor. And I've heard argued by different scholars and different biblical writers that basically Israel becomes a persecuting power. Like they were meant to be this nation of priests and agents of grace and truth. And now they've really become a religious political power with the king and slaves and oppression. They've become the very thing that they escaped.
Mm-hmm. My father whipped you with whips and I will whip you with scorpions.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, not a great political speech, not a great moment.
And not a great witness to Solomon's witness.
No. And so do you see merit in looking at 666 as maybe a prophecy, painting a picture that the church, or what was meant to be maybe a religious community that represented Jesus, ends up becoming a false religion and a persecuting power?
Oh, definitely. I mean, after all, Solomon was a son of David. So was Jesus. You see? So that is a powerful connection there. Solomon was a king of peace. The very name means peace. There was no wars fought during his reign, even though oppression occurred. That seems to have been relatively peaceful. When you go back in Revelation 13 to the beast that comes out of the sea, it looks a lot like Jesus.
Huh.
It has a ministry of 42 months. Jesus' ministry was 3.5 years long. It has a death and a resurrection, and even uses the language of the cross to describe that. And I could go further into that. So whatever's going on in Revelation 13 is a poster child for everything that can go wrong with Christian faith. And so Seventh-day Adventists have understood that history, pointing to the historical shortcomings of the Christian church.
Mm-hmm.
For many, many centuries, you know, various people have pointed that out. Adventists have been among the loudest, and it's maybe not even popular today to do that, but here's the point. In schools today, history has been rewritten to some degree. History used to be a whitewash of Christianity. Now the historians are saying, hey, Christianity did a lot of bad things. You have the Crusades, you have slavery, you have colonialism, and you go down the list. There's the Inquisition, etc. So young people today are growing up very much aware the Christian church is not all that great a place. It has done seemingly almost as much harm as it has done good. And so a lot of the younger generation is looking in other directions.
Yeah.
Now, how would I explain that as a Seventh-day Adventist? I would say simply this, that we believe that there is a cosmic conflict in the universe, that God and Satan are at war within the universe, and that's a battle that encompasses everything. It encompasses every nation, every religion, every political party, every denomination, every individual. It's all part of that battle. The New Testament says, you know, that taking captive our thoughts, it uses military language for that, taking captive even our thoughts is so critical. We're all part of that battle.
Yeah.
Ephesians 6, you know, the armor of God to fight against the attacks of Satan. So if you believe in a cosmic conflict, then you would be surprised if any institution that named the name of Christ would be totally pure. And so Revelation 13 may point to some specific issues in the Middle Ages, and I believe it does. But those issues are not given for us to point fingers at other religious groups. They're given to us as warnings, you know, there but for the grace of God go you and your organization.
Right.
Collective selfishness is an ugly thing, but it's very natural anytime human beings get together. We protect our turf.
Yes.
I'm sure that doesn't happen at Union College, you know, but even in Christian universities, you can't move forward on anything because someone's saying, well, we've always had this number of classes and we're not going to accept one less, you know.
Right.
So, yeah. So the fact of Christianity as a flawed religion, I think, is a reality. And that's what Revelation 13, in my view, is all about. God is saying, I'm not going to be surprised. You know, when that time comes, don't be surprised. And there will be people within that medieval church who will be my people. They'll be truly faithful. They will be giants of their time. Not going to name names, but there are some through history where people have said, wow, this is a uniquely special person. You know? At the same time, some horrible, horrible things. Millions of people were persecuted, martyred, except during by the medieval church.
Yeah.
So it's a very, very disturbing picture, but at the same time, God was still working there. There is still in his people there. And I think we can take comfort in that when we see flaws in our own denominations, to realize that's part of the cosmic conflict, part of that big picture. And it also means God is still working with us.
Yeah.
So when we see flaws in our own denomination, God has not given up. He's still with us.
Yeah.
And I found people in every this background that I've just had immediate kinship with and said, wow, this person believes differently than I do, but boy, this person is really sold out on God, and God can use a person like this. So to me, that's encouraging to know that God has not given up on any entity.
Yeah.
At the same time, the warning is be very much aware that being human is going to do harm as well as good.
Yeah. No, that's good. And tying it into the theme of the podcast, you see in Revelation 13 this sort of monstrous entity and kind of a warning that even if something starts out fresh and I'll put pure in quotes, you know, there's always this tendency for it to become monstrous. As you pointed out, Christianity has a long history of doing amazing things and also being monstrous. I can't remember the name off the top of my head, but I read a book from a missionary who is saying, you know, one thing you never do when you're sharing your faith with people who've never heard of Christianity is you don't start by defending the church. You'll never win that. You know, you start with Jesus, you know, and
maybe even start with an apology.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. And then see if Jesus is a subject they're willing to consider. Yeah. When I hear those sorry stories, an apology is the immediate reaction that I think is fairly appropriate. Now, here's the thing, because you were bringing up 666, and the medieval church is very interesting. For about 1,000 years, the medieval church was run by a leader who adopted the title Vicarius Filii Dei, Vicar of the Son of God.
Uh-huh.
And that was an official title of the leader of the church from about 750 AD to about 1800, was the official title. It you don't find it, I think, on the Vatican website today, and you wouldn't have found it in the early centuries of the church, but it did fit that whole period in there. And it's interesting that Vicarius Filii Dei in Latin numerals does come out to 666. So I don't think by itself that's a powerful argument at all, but it's just interesting that if Revelation 13 is focusing on the medieval church, it's interesting that the crowning title of the leader of the medieval church would happen to be fit 666. So it's a number that fascinates people, but by itself it's not the best evidence of what the fulfillment will be. But it's a subsidiary piece.
Yeah, and it's interesting. And this makes me think of, you know, your comment, you know, except by the grace of God, go I, or you, or all of us. Is when you read in the New Testament, there's moments where the biblical writers have mentioned the spirit of the Antichrist or the Antichrist is in the world, and it's always they've come out from us. You know, it's never like those people over there. It's always out of our own community. And that's the sobering part, is we always, and this is just my perspective, I think we really like to, if we can nail that number down to one specific individual, we can blame them for everything, as opposed to looking at it and saying, you know, this is, you know, there are certainly historical and future fulfillments, specific fulfillments. However, the grand theme of this number and this concept is, if I am not careful, you know, I can easily go from being a follower of Christ to being having the spirit of Antichrist and being more consumed with my own power and my own way and end up doing some very cruel and monstrous things.
Yeah. No, very, very much the case. You're familiar with the concept of a poster child?
Yes.
Especially entities that, you know, desire donations to help feed children, et cetera, will pick one child and put that child in the picture, tell that child's story, because that one child represents all the others.
Yes.
What I see Revelation 13 doing, while it does seem to focus particularly on one aspect of the Christian church that was particularly problematic. I see it more as a poster child.
Yeah.
I mean, it's saying, you know, like you said, here, but except for the grace of God, you know, here go all of you. God is giving a sample of how bad things can get and saying, don't get so wedded to a particular human form of religion that you end up going down with the ship, so to speak.
Yeah. So just a question that comes to mind is, as you're looking around the contemporary Christian landscape, where do you see areas, not focusing or highlighting any particular institution or denomination, but where do you see just general areas that Christians need to be a little bit more careful in because we're acting a bit monstrous?
Well, a very important concept, I think, in recent philosophical thought is the concept of empire. And Rome was a powerful empire. Empire is when one branch of humanity dominates many. Okay. Empires usually happen economically rather than politically. Pretty rare somebody just says, I'm going to conquer the world. You know, maybe Alexander the Great was that. I'm going to conquer the world. Let me just go out and, you know. Usually you're not going to get several tens of thousands of people to commit to 10 years just to fit your ambitions. Usually there's other motives. And what tends to happen with empires, and Rome was very much like that, is that they become wealthy. It's a particular section becomes wealthy, and they have business all over the known world. But then the problem is when you've got business, there's always bad actors out there who are trying to steal and so on. So you need to protect those businesses. And that's where the army then goes out, the navy goes out, the tentacles go out to protect the economic interests.
Uh-huh.
And so the empire often, you know, not many people, I think, have said, well, let me build a big empire. Hitler may be another who seems to have had that in mind. But even that was probably economic, being driven. The United States is the greatest empire of human history. Now, we don't think of it as such because we don't have political control.
Right.
But in a sense, the United States does. There's no nation that can make a major decision without asking the question, well, what does the United States think about this? What is their military going to do? What is the CIA going to do if we do this? Are we going to get ourselves in trouble there? And so everybody, you know, I mean, the whole war on terror was basically saying we want every country on earth to distinguish between the good people and the bad people in each of your families. Osama bin Laden had 52 brothers. I think it was just brothers alone, 52. Half of them lived in the United States. Half of them were pro-U.S., you know?
Yeah.
Well, if you're going to deal with the bin Laden family, you have to be able to distinguish between those who are on one side and those who are on the other.
Right.
Which is very intrusive.
Yeah.
You see? And you're asking Saudi Arabia now to break up these families by rooting out the terrorists. So it was a very challenging thing. So the U.S. has its tentacles out everywhere, and we don't even think about it. We just know that Coca-Cola is everywhere. We don't realize that Coca-Cola can operate the way it does because it's protected by the threat of American intervention, military intervention. McDonald's, you know, recently they closed down in Russia because when the war broke out there, the U.S. was not going to protect them within Russia anymore. And so after some time, most of those American companies shut down. But should peace come and the United States and Russia get back together, I would imagine many of those companies will be back in as fast as they can go because it was good business.
Yeah. Yeah. So this brings up another interesting thing. There's a lot of discussion in the U.S. and in prophecy, at least historically from a Seventh-day Adventist perspective, of Christian nationalism. Do you think Revelation speaks to this issue? And do you think people who have studied particularly the earth beast in Revelation, which I believe historically from an Adventist perspective has been the United States, do you think people have forgotten the U.S.'s role and the elements of Christian nationalism and how that might play out as things move towards an end-time eschatological fulfillment?
Yeah, that's a great point to bring up here because that goes back to what we were talking about earlier. you know, God and Satan both at work in every entity. And I think many Christians have embraced the United States as sort of the last bastion of Christian faith. Europe has kind of given it up. You know, the United States within the Western world is the largest and the wealthiest body of Christians anywhere. So if the gospel is going to go forth, it's going to, you know, emanate to some degree from the United States. So many have embraced the United States as the protector of Christian faith, a defender of Christian faith. And Christians can go around the world and witness for the gospel because the United States makes that possible, you know, with its protection, etc. So a lot of people have embraced American nationalism, but I think scripture would give us a big caution on that.
Uh-huh.
Because the United States, for all the beautiful things it has done, has definitely been involved in the other direction. And you know, people talk about how slavery was tolerated for 250 years in this country. People have noted that the Native Americans were forcibly removed. People talk about Chinese immigrants working almost as slaves to build the American railroads and the internment of Japanese in World War II, etc. So, I mean, you go through all of that and you realize that even though it's one of the brightest and best of all human experiments, it's still seriously, seriously flawed. And so I think it was probably countercultural back in the 19th century for Adventists to identify the United States as one of the beasts.
Yeah.
As an empire with fearsome potential. I think we can see today that is an interpretation that makes a ton of sense.
I pastored a church that was close to a military base once, and it was a wonderful congregation and had so many good experiences there and just tremendously faithful, kind, generous people. And I remember asking one of my church members who had a very high rank in the U.S. military, I said, so how do you, as a Seventh-day Adventist Christian, looks at this application of this beast in Revelation to the U.S., how do you process that with your service, you know, to your country? And he said, I serve my country because I believe in its ideals, its stated ideals, and what, all the beautiful things, but I recognize at the same time that all these things I defend will one day, you know, become corrupted and change. And so I think for a lot of people, it's a very difficult thing to hold dear the love of your country and what it stands for, at least on paper, and at least what we, you know, have popular sentiments about, and also recognizing that all these things that I love about my country, according to my view of scripture, will vanish, you know. And so it's a challenging place to be sometimes.
Well, the interesting thing, when you go to the text itself, Revelation 13:11, says, I saw another beast coming out of the earth. He had two horns like a lamb, but he spoke like a dragon. It doesn't say that the lamb is first and the dragon is second. It could be read as simply saying this is a dual character.
Yeah. Huh.
And so reading history as it is often read today, slavery was not something that came in the dragon period.
Yeah.
It was there right at the beginning, 1619. All right.
Uh-huh.
So the United States was conflicted from day one. And it's interesting. I was reading a little Thomas Jefferson not too long ago. And Jefferson is a really amazing guy. And the clarity with which he processed these great ideas that were the foundation of our country is pretty amazing. But he kept slaves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he justified that for a long time by saying, you know, they have not been given the opportunities, the education, so we need to train them. We need to educate them before we let them go. Because if we just let them go, they'll be worse off than they are now. And there's some sense in that, you know. But he recognized when he wrote down the words, all men are created equal. You know, some people say, well, it was all white men are created equal. Well, Jefferson knew that when he wrote those words that slavery would come to an end one day. And it shows you, I think, the patience of God. I think God was in those words at that particular period of time, but it took 100 more years before they bore the full flower. And even then, another 100 years before we could even conceive of having, you know, a person of that ancestry as president and think truly in more equal terms. So it takes time, a tremendous amount of time. But the United States, I suspect, was a conflicted figure in God's eyes from the first. So Christian nationalism, the kind, you know, my country right or wrong, is probably a step beyond, you know, where Jesus would have us go.
Yeah. So pivoting to a couple of lighter questions before we wrap things up, and I really appreciate the insights, historical, biblical, exegetical. It's been really, really good. Revelation has a lot of monstrous imagery, and the book of Daniel does too. Out of all the images that could have been chosen, why do you think Jesus chose to put monsters in a book that's meant to reveal him?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because we often think Revelation is the revelation of the monsters, but its actual title is Revelation of Jesus Christ. So there's a fascinating correlation. I think in part it was a genre that was chosen because it worked in that time.
Yeah.
You know, I think of the cartoon The Lion King, which my kids liked very much when they were small. Lion King is actually an African apocalypse. It has animals in it, but it's not an animal story. It's deeply psychological. It's deeply political. And it portrays a perfect world that is ruined by evil forces and redeemed by a son. And so then the world becomes beautiful again. So you have, it's a genre that nobody even thinks about today. It just came naturally. You know, that was a cool way to do this. And of course, now you've got Avengers and Star Wars and Lord of the Rings. This genre of apocalyptic is very powerful today. And it was back then. There are many, many apocalyptic books outside the Bible. So when Jesus revealed himself to John, he used something that was familiar. He used language that made sense. Now, today we may have to, you know, work hard to recapture some of that initial power. But originally it was given because it worked. It got people's attention. And as they pondered these images, you know, just like Jesus' parables, as people ponder these images, you know, are there monsters today? Where would I look? You know, see, are there, you know, godly people today? What would they look like? And so, you know, in the end, the conflict is between the image of God and the image of the beast. When the term image of the beast was chosen in chapter 13, it's a deliberate reminder of the image of God. It's a creation image. And it shows that Satan has a purpose for undermining the image of God wherever he can. And that's where I said there's kind of a spiritual thing that he seeks to distort and destroy the image of God in human beings. There must be some reason. There must be something really, really important for Satan. And I would suggest that in the book of Hebrews, it tells us that God made human beings a little lower than the angels for a time. He says, God has not subjected the future to angels. He subjected it to human beings. So I'd like to suggest that when God created human beings, he was creating creatures more like himself than any other creatures he had made. Angels are never said to be the image of God. Angels don't have the power to procreate. There's two things right there where human beings are different from the other creatures God has made. It may be that Satan was jealous when he heard about this plan of God. And maybe to some degree that's what he was reacting against. Satan hates the image of God because in a way it tells him that he's a tool in God's hands. He's not the big kahuna.
Yeah.
And that God can take another creature and put them in Lucifer's place and have these creatures who are like God, ruling the universe in the future. So it seems to me that the creation story is about a plan of God to do something unique and new in the universe that got derailed to some degree by the fall, but God will restore it again in the end. And the final battle is Satan doing his best to undermine that image of God, because it's going to end him in the end. And so Revelation 13 is building on huge themes that go all the way back to creation.
That's a powerful thought and a great place, I think, to conclude our podcast. However, I do want to ask, if people want to connect with you, what's a good place to find you, and what resources would you recommend if they really want to get into the book of Revelation?
Okay. Yeah, well, I'm at Loma Linda University, and so I can be reached at Loma Linda University. I also have a website, thebattleofarmageddon.com. It was available. I took it. I got to get that one. Battleofarmageddon.com. So there's a website where they can see a lot of free materials, including Facebook commentary on the book of Revelation, which I am writing verse by verse and posting day by day. And you can find many of those chapters, finished chapters, accessible there by simply clicking on a link. I've written a number of books on Revelation. Probably the one I would recommend is The Deep Things of God, which is a how-to.
Okay.
It teaches people how to study Revelation so that they don't read themselves into the book, but let the book speak for itself and teach us something. So, yeah, those are some things. I do have a program called GPS, God's Prophetic Surprises, on Loma Linda Broadcasting Network, LLBN.TV. People can access those programs. We've done almost 200 programs going verse by verse through the book of Revelation. So there's some resources that are there.
That's fantastic. Thank you.
I think you've actually written some stuff, haven't you?
I have. Yeah, I have a couple things. Book of Revelation Made Simple, which you graciously read and made some comments on. And we'll certainly make sure we put in all of these resources into our show notes so people can follow up. But thank you so much for being a guest today on Beast and Bible, Dr. Pauline.
It's a delightful to see you again.
The mark of the beast has more to do with a symbolic allegiance to an oppressive religious political power than a specific physical mark. It represents those who try to force their worldview on others, being willing by any means necessary to make people believe what they do, sometimes on pain of death. The number 666, whether tattooed on the skin, a house address, or the total a cashier rings up because you made poor choices, is not really what the Mark of the Beast is all about. In 1897, Adventist pioneer Ellen White wrote, "Forced is the last resort of every false religion." That statement challenges us to reflect on how we share our faith. Do we invite dialogue and discussion, or do we simply tell people what they're to believe and threaten consequences if they don't? In the spirit of Isaiah 1:18, do we gather to reason together, or do we array our institutional and social forces against someone who might disagree with us without giving them a chance to share their perspective? The mark of false religion is force. The mark of being a follower of true religion, according to Jesus in John 13:35, is our love for one another. I hope you've enjoyed and been challenged by this episode of Beast and Bible. We are two episodes away from ending our first season, and so we have saved some of the spiciest content for last. Our next two episodes deal with some of the most potent topics that arise in Christian conversations that revolve around a phenomenon that began almost 40 years ago in the 1980s, a phenomenon that involved panic, tales of strange rituals, literature making claims that secret occult societies were on the loose, Ouija boards, and of course that perennial source of evangelical fear, Dungeons and Dragons. Join us next time for our final two-part episode exploring the satanic panic of the 1980s. Thank you for listening to Beast and Bible.
Beast and Bible is written, researched, produced, and hosted by Dr. Seth Pierce. Ethan Geck is our editor. Logo design and social media by Chelsea Ernina. Equipment and tech help from the dynamic duo James Giganti and Stephen Husett. Producing and project help from me, Heather Moore. Thanks for listening to Beast and Bible. Tell your friends about us, and don't forget to leave a nightlight on after dark.